This weekend marks the third annual Kalamazoo Poetry Festival. Each year, local poets hold readings and workshops to perfect their art, but the highlight of the fest has got to be the guest artists. One of those artists is Detroit poet Jamal May. May has won the Beatrice Hawley Award, the ALA Notable Book Award, and has been a finalist for the NAACP Image Award, as well as the Kate Tufts Discovery Award. He's also won the Rust Belt Regional Slam Championship 3 times. He's on the phone with me now. Hi, Jamal. Thanks for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, a poet once told me that many poets have a hard time bringing their work to life during a reading, but you don't seem to have this problem. You have a very big presence on stage and really connect with those audience members. Is this something that comes naturally for you, or do you work on that?
It kind of came naturally in the sense that I didn't know what I was doing the first time I threw myself into that kind of a mode. But I've actually really studied it and kind of watched what happens. And the thing that I figured out to kind of bring myself to that connection you're talking about was to actually try to get out of the way of the poems. I had a lot of social anxiety growing up, and crowds were, like, terrifying me most of my life. So the way that I figured out to be able to the thing I figured out to be able to do it was that nobody came to see me. They came to hear poems. And so if I can get out of the way of the work, then the work becomes the conduit between us. It's not necessarily directly connecting to an audience or a reader. It's more so the work is the conduit between us.
Right. So you're kind of almost acting out the work in a way.
Right. So basically the piece that I've written, it already has punctuation. It already has pacing. It already has syntax. And so what happens when you get up to read that work is a lot of times people kind of get in the way of those things that are already there. So I didn't think of it as like, okay, I need to perform the work as much as I just need to let the pauses be where the pauses are, let the tone shift the way the tone shifts and not fight with the piece, just let the piece do what it does. I mean, I edited it and I wrote it to have those fluctuations and that energy. And so with me, is when I get up to share the work, it's not so much that I'm trying to figure out how to present it in any kind of way as much as I'm trying to let it breathe and do what I already tried to do on the page.
Right, right. Now, you grew up in Detroit and taught poetry in Detroit public schools, right?
That's correct. I was part of the Inside Out Literary Arts Project, which puts writers in schools. We kind of take over English classroom for the day. And I also worked with the Citywide Poets, which is an after-school workshop, and also where our Brave New Voices Youth Slam team pulls from in the city of Detroit.
Yeah, why is this so important to you to get poetry in public schools?
There's a few different reasons. Some of the primary ones are things like, from a personal standpoint, I saw what being given power over language did for me as far as my self-esteem and just a vision for what I could do in the world. Being able to articulate, I feel like everyone has something complex stirring inside of them, an interior landscape that is very rich and dense. But how you move through the world is dependent upon your ability to articulate that for others, because we all live in a shared reality where we have to interact and share space. And so to make your life, to manifest your life, you have to be able to communicate this interior landscape. And so poetry gave me that. It gave me this tool to connect to others. And so it was important for me to just kind of give that to other people, because I always thought, like, yo, if I knew about this when I was a teenager, like, how different would things be? And so that was why Inside Out became so important to me. Another aspect of it is also just the idea of showing people that there are different paths and towards the life that you want. I think sometimes it gets the choices get kind of presented to children get limited, particularly in urban settings. And so just for me to be in front of students regularly as a person who made a living through a creative art form, an art form that's ancient, that, you know, predates literacy even, to show that that's a thing that still happens. I think that's a part of what I think I try to bring to the classroom too, just encouraging people to like really take a look at what you like in the world and see if you can make someone pay you to do it.
Yeah, and there are a couple of poems, especially in Hum, which is your first book, that are kind of Detroit-centric. You know, Do you feel like the way that the city has changed has also affected your work?
I'm not sure if I've seen the effects of the change yet, because, well, or maybe I have, depending on where you point the lens, because I feel like my work is very much about change in general, about the persistence of it. So even as the city changes, what ends up happening is this reverse kind of effect where my work changes in conjunction to the city changing. Now, if I've written something about my high school or elementary school, those poems mean something different now that the one school has a new building and the other one doesn't exist anymore. So I think there's a shift that happens in both directions when you see the world kind of changing around you. I actually have I drove by my elementary school a few weeks ago and saw as it was being torn down, and I have a poem that mentions an excavator taking a building in its mouth, and then I give an image that was just in that poem, and then I saw it after my book was already done and going to print. I see this image of it in my neighborhood. So that's been what's fascinating. What's been really interesting is not so much how the city changes change my work as much as how the past work seems to change around the new context.
Yeah, and you know, talking about buildings being torn down and things like this, you know, I, for lack of a better term, I'm seeing a lot of what they call ruin porn. You know, seeing these pictures of people taking pictures of Detroit, you know, and all of the abandoned buildings and the graffiti and things like this. And, you know, you talk about some of the decay of Detroit in Hum, but you're very careful not to romanticize it. You know, why did you make that decision?
One of the things that actually, this is a funny thing about Hum. I ended up dedicating it to the interior lives of Detroiters. Because a lot of those poems were written at a time where I actively was trying to not write about Detroit, because I felt like there was a lot of lazy art that you could make about the city, and I was seeing it everywhere. Like you said, the ruin porn or the kind of lazy ode to Motown. You know, I felt like it was Detroit had like a lot of fine points you just kind of easily kind of gloss over, and so you got either that kind of stuff where it was like kind of this one-dimensional look at the city, or you got the kind of just doom and gloom single dimension. And so I kind of was just trying to avoid that period. I felt like I was more interested in people's interactions with each other and interior experiences. And once I had all these poems together, I realized they were the interior experiences of people I saw as Detroiters. And so it was kind of a craft approach that led me away from it. And it's something I do commonly. If there's something I'm wrestling with or something that's kind of a tricky area to pull off, I'll just try to go completely left of it and kind of skirt the edge. And so by me trying not to write about Detroit, I feel like I end up being able to get this other angle, because the thing that I think gets forgotten a lot in the national media or these kind of side glances the city gets is, you know, that like people, like, there are people living here, working, doing their thing, and have been for a long time. And people almost seem shocked that people live in Detroit. Like, when I travel the country, they're like, you live there? Like, it's a real place. So I think it was me trying to swerve away from the expected kind of language of the city that kind of let me, people seem to agree, avoid the standard one-dimensional look that you tend to get about the city.
And, you know, you mentioned that you really were trying to not write about Detroit. And, you know, you address a lot of issues that we're all talking about today in your work in one way or another. You know, you talk about racism, gun violence, PTSD was mentioned. But you say that you don't start out thinking this is going to be an issues poem. You know, what's your process?
So my process can shift from time to time. I feel like it's one of the things that keeps me fresh. Like, if I feel like I'm kind of stuck in a mode, then I'll just change the process altogether. But typically, it's rare for a poem to come out of a specific theme. Like, okay, I want to write a poem about X. Usually, it'll kind of start with a curious juxtaposition, like seeing two things in a new way as they press against each other. Because I'm always looking for the space between things. or the friction created. The polarity is just kind of what I think moves my work, moves the world, really. Like, you got to have friction to get some kind of movement, right? So my process usually starts with finding something that is pushing and pulling with itself. And it might just be an image, it might be a metaphor, or it might be a weird phrase I overheard or a phrase I thought of. And then from there, it'll kind of spin out. And so when the sociopolitical issues come up, I think about the time I heard Surge from the band System of a Down. He was talking about why people were asking, why they had why not all their songs were political, or why sometimes the songs were really silly. And he was saying because music was a representation of all that they are. And they're not always very serious. They're not always like partying, but sometimes they're either of those things. And so the issues that come up in my poems are more so just because I don't fight anything off. Anything that comes in makes it in. And so it's kind of hard to not be considering some of the issues that we're dealing with. If you're paying attention, it's like it weighs on you. And so for me, I try to let the work surprise me. Like Ian Forster said, I don't know what I think until I see what I say. And so I'm always trying to let the language lead me somewhere new. And then in the revision process, I'm kind of uncovering that deeper thought. I start kind of chiseling away at what I've collected until I got something shapely that challenges me and hopefully challenges someone else to kind of move their mind in an unexpected way, I guess.
Yeah, and speaking of chiseling, I heard that you're kind of fascinated by the mechanical. Can you explain that?
Lately, the way I've been thinking about the mechanical is asking the question, what is unnatural? Because we think of the things that are human made as unnatural, but if you just think of the human as another creature on Earth that just builds things, what's more unnatural about the stuff that we build versus stuff that nature builds, like honeycombs and dams and things like that. And also looking at the mechanical, we think of metal. We might think of metal as cold and inorganic, but metal comes from the earth as well. And so the way I look at the mechanical in my work is kind of considering machinery as an extension of humankind rather than this thing that humankind is up against. I think typically we'll pit the machine versus the human, but what we actually see more in our technological development is the machinery being a kind of side-by-side extension of what humanity can do. And so in this weird way, the machine kind of becomes a more spiritual kind of almost experience in that it's an extension of the self that is outside of it. So that's kind of like how the more broad way the mechanical makes its way into the philosophy of how the poems get constructed. And then just in a more literal way, I go into the diction of machinery and the work, particularly when I'm talking about the human body. That's kind of like a really straightforward technique, just drawing those parallels between the machinery and the human. But for me, underneath that structure is something kind of more complex and kind of a deeper query that I think I go into a little bit in the second book in some tiny ways.
Yeah, and, talking about the second book, which is called The Big Book of Exit Strategies, love the title.
Thank you.
That just came out this year. You talk about the pains of maturity and the loss of imagination. Now, you're still pretty young. Do you feel this shift happening as you get older?
I actually feel, strangely, I feel like my imagination right now is probably more potent than it was 5-6 years ago in my, 20s. I haven't felt maybe the expected shift, but I have felt the shift. There's kind of been this realization that, and I think some of it came through writing through this process in the book, is that I'm always kind of creating paradoxes. So anytime I'm talking about the slipperiness of imagination, I'm using imaginative language to get there. So there's all this is something that's kind of common in my work, creating these dualities. So So what's fascinating to me is to see the increasing pull away from the imaginative as you age, but the increasing capacity for it if you're paying attention. Because my brain is more, I have more experience, I have more memories, I have more things to tap. What's unfortunate is that a lot of us, there's a pressure to not tap into that range of memory because we are made up of whatever our memories are. So to remain what we would think of as solid or consistent, we may kind of narrow down the grouping of memories that we'll stick with. But what's beautiful is to be able to remember your full self. And I feel like poetry gives me that back, this ability to kind of remember more of me. So while I do feel there's a increasing pressure to be less than imaginative, I'm finding, at least personally, anecdotally for me, this increasing capacity to, like, explore. Like, I've been back to drawing and painting and music and all these other art forms that I kind of thought of as for when I was young. They're like, all of these kind of things are back as part of my life. So I don't know, it's kind of a strange paradox to feel the pressure to not be while feeling the capacity expand.
Yeah, and you talked about drawing. I know that you at least attempted at one time to draw a superhero comic, and that kind of led you into fiction. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah, this was when I was really young. I was a kid, I always wanted to draw. That was my thing. And I never thought of myself as someone who wrote. But now when I look back, I realize that drawing comic books, like, is a ton of writing. And so I had this comic book called The Ultra Force, which actually ended up becoming a real comic book on Malibu Comics. I had nothing to do with it. But I like to think of this notion that Malibu Comics got the idea from my elementary school self. But The Ultra Force had this big conclusion where it was going to be this double-sized issue where I had blank paper, which was very rare to come by. It was like large blank paper that I could fold over, so it really felt like a comic book to me. And I was working on this thing for, I have no idea how long. It was this long, epic, I'm drawing panel by panel. And I eventually gave up, frustrated with the project, and because I was like, I wanted to finish this storyline, but I couldn't draw another panel. I was like, I'm done. I can't draw anymore. And I was just so frustrated, like, that I had to just abandon this story. And I always wished that somebody would have told me back then that there was a thing called fiction, where I could just write the story. Because I abandoned this whole storyline just because I didn't want to draw it anymore. But it's just so funny to think of, like, how perspective changes what's actually happening, because I saw myself as a visual artist. Like, I didn't fathom another way to tell a story, even though my twin sister was writing stories all the time. That was her thing. Like, she was the writer and I was the artist. But now that I'm kind of going back, I've been writing a little bit of prose, and I have a kind of a novel that I have more parts to now than I can ignore. So I probably have to write it at this point. And it's like, it's kind of throwing me back to that time where I wanted to finish a story. Like, I'm a good, like, I like telling stories, and I kind of have the itch to tell this longer story. And just like I did back then, but now I know that I don't have to draw the panels. But now that I'm drawing again, of course, I'm thinking maybe it's a graphic novel. So we'll see.
Yeah. What are some of your goals coming up? Are you working on anything new?
So right now, the different mediums are kind of like becoming a focus. With the Chapbook Press, me and Tarfia Faizula run together, Organic Weapon Arts. We've been expanding into doing video and some more print materials, like broadsides. And so right now, it's kind of just organizing that. We've got new people that are coming on board, like Anna Claire Hodge and Todrick Luthen and Tommy Blount are going to be like new, some writers that are coming on board to help out. So we're kind of expanding that stuff. So I'm kind of just in that mode right now, kind of thinking video, thinking audio, and thinking about fundraising. And then also this fall, I'll be starting teaching at the University of Michigan, which I'm really looking forward to. So those are kind of the big changes. And also touring, the Big Book of Exit Strategies, of course.
Well, sounds like a busy schedule. Would you be able to read a poem for us?
All right, so I'll do a poem from the Big Book of Exit Strategies. There are birds here for Detroit. There are birds here. There are so many birds here, is what I was trying to say when they said those birds were metaphors for what is trapped between fences and buildings. No, the birds are here to root around for bread. The girl's hands tear and toss like confetti. No, I don't mean the bread is torn like cotton. I said confetti. And no, not the confetti a tank can make out of a building. I mean the confetti the boy can't stop smiling about. And no, his smile is not much like a skeleton at all. And no, their neighborhood is not like a war zone. I'm trying to say their neighborhood is as tattered and feathered as anything else, as shadow pierced by sun and light parted by shadow dance as anything else. But they won't stop saying how lovely the ruins, how ruined the lovely children must be in your birdless city.
Jamal, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jamal May is one of two guest artists at this year's Kalamazoo Poetry Festival, along with Natalie Diaz. Both poets will do a reading Saturday night at 7 at the Kalamazoo Institute of Arts.